Welcome to this week's 2 Men in the Middle. This is where two dudes from the Midwest get together and try to make sense of politics and current affairs on a weekly basis. I am Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And this week, we're going to talk about everybody's favorite criminal now, Rick Gates, part of the Paul Manafort trial, the crisis of undocumented families. Guess what, folks? It's still out there. And finally, we're going to cover Tuesday's election. So, Brandon, why don't you kind of start us off a little bit in framing up what's been happening with the Paul Manafort trial, and we'll kind of dive in and try to make sense out of some of that stuff.
Yeah, well, Paul Manafort's partner, Rick Gates, is testifying for the prosecution. So he's a cooperating witness. And so all of the sleaze that we assumed was happening, we now have confirmed.
It's as sleazy as you thought it was.
Exactly. You have, you know, dozens of offshore bank accounts, yeah. Money laundering, embezzlement, tax fraud that was pretty extensive. We also learned that Rick Gates was actually siphoning money from his, you know, partner as well, from Manafort as well. Yeah. So that was going on. So you have all of this now kind of in context. And again, this is the tip of the iceberg. So details are still coming out. But I don't think any of us like really are shocked by this, but it's somebody from the inside giving credibility to what we all thought was happening.
Paul Manafort is the sleaziest guy in America. We all kind of knew that. This just kind of reinforces that whole narrative that you talked about last week. He's got a long history of this. This is nothing new for him. Rick Gates, I find him to be somewhat entertaining. You know, the stories of him ripping off hundreds of thousands of dollars from Manafort as part of his expense account, and then using that to help me out, keep his fourth, fifth, sixth, he had any number of mistresses, and you know, keeping them in an apartment in London, and him having to testify.
He kept busy. He was a busy guy.
I mean, if your boss is Paul Manafort, do you really feel bad about scrimping a little on your expense report?
Well, no, and I don't think we should be surprised by it. And I think that's why it's so, you know, ridiculous. Again, common defense tactic that you try to poke holes in the credibility of, you know, witnesses for the prosecution. But what would you expect if you're joining a criminal enterprise, which is basically what this is? You're not going to get, you know, very, you know, upright, moral people. You're going to get questionable people.
So here's a pro tip, I think, for maybe everybody that's a boss. If you wear $1 million worth of suits around your employees, don't be shocked when they throw an extra comma or an extra zero on their expense report and steal a little money from you. Oh, I think that's kind of natural behavior.
Well, you're almost inviting it. I mean, if you are lax in paying your taxes, you're funneling money between different accounts, it's just an invite for your partner or one of your employees to skimp a little, you know, put a little on the
Manafort
side for themselves.
Manafort shockingly stared him down in the trial when he was admitting all of this. And what you just said, dude, you're one of the OGs in the courtroom for slimy behavior and stealing and hiding money. Now suddenly your defense is that this other guy who now is just as slimy as you, somehow it's his fault and not yours. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that doesn't hold up at all. I mean, he should have known from the beginning what he was getting into. I find it was also interesting, fascinating, I guess you would say, the revelation that Manafort was irate when he received a tax bill that he wasn't expecting, because again, the whole plan was, you know, we're going to be fraudulent and we're going to not have to pay taxes.
I'm working really hard to rip off the government. Right. Now you guys,
what's this all about?
What
a tax bill?
I mean, come on. Why do you think I park money over in Cyprus, IRS?
Exactly. Ugh. It's just, you know, again, I mean, the thought, though, that they could get away with this. I mean, and that they thought that, you know, for, you know, as long as it happened. But again, it speaks to the minds of criminals. They think in the moment. They don't think down the road. They don't think long term and, you know, cover their tracks. It's all about just, you know, short-term gratification.
We used to live next to a U.S. Marshal, and he always used to tell us that the idea of the criminal mastermind, that only exists in Hollywood.
Right.
Most of these people are impulsive. Most of them don't think things through. And in the heat of the moment, they think they can get away with something, and they do it. And they get away with it once, and that leads to repeated behavior of trying to get away from it over and over and over again. So I'm pretty sure Manafort is going to be found guilty of something. He's going to be facing some sort of long-term sentence, and that he's going to have to fulfill that sentence. If there were a deal coming for Manafort, it feels like that would have been in place by now.
Yeah, I think we're way past that. I don't think there's an opportunity for that to happen at this point.
Following the you give up the person above you, it feels like the deal was Gates giving up Manafort, and that's where that's going to stop. So
right.
I think this is the shot across the bow to Trump and his team and the indictments that are coming next, that we will go to court. There's an expectation that we are going to win these cases, and that there's going to be people facing serious jail time at this point based on the Mueller probe and kind of what they're bringing to the
table. It's a show of strength by Mueller. Yeah. He's not going to back down, and that this is just the beginning, and, you know, he's not going to roll over. And also that, you know, all of this that's happening on the periphery, you know, that this is all fair game too, that there's not going to be any stone left unturned, which tells us there could be many more, you know, people to fall.
Yeah.
You know, and this is at the end game.
And this was all kind of a sideshow. There's this wacky judge, T.S. Ellis, who has a history of being very difficult on prosecutors. He has a history of calling attention to himself. He has a history of making off-the-cuff comments. He has certainly lived up to his billing.
Yeah, the court romantics, that was something else.
I thought mostly a judge was there to suppress all of that, to make sure this is something that stays at a certain level of decor. I think the prosecution team today filed an official complaint against him because he reprimanded them in front of the jury for something he earlier told them that they could do. I think he had to apologize to the jury today for that. So this whole thing has just been kind of a clown show.
It's bizarre.
From start to finish.
He also instructed the attorneys to not give facial expressions that could be biased, I guess, in the minds of the jurors.
I don't know.
So the prosecutor was looking down apparently when the judge was speaking to him, and then he got reprimanded by the judge for looking down. It's really bizarre.
The prosecution got irritated and kind of casually, flippantly said yeah at the judge when he told him something, and he got reprimanded for that. So it's just been this back and forth. This whole thing has been fairly entertaining, but it feels like it's just a wasted exercise to get to the point that most people know we're going, which is Manafort's going to go to jail for tax evasion.
The evidence is overwhelming at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's been interesting that one criminal stands up and admits to all of this criminality, and basically to get the guy in front of him to go to jail. I mean, it is kind of odd that Rick Gates, who admitted just as much criminality, I think, as Paul Manafort has, he's going to get somewhat of a walk on this, and Manafort is probably going to spend the remainder of his adult life in jail.
Yeah, and that's typically kind of what happens in these cases. I mean, it's a big win for the prosecution to have somebody on the inside to be able to corroborate timelines and details and transactions, and they have that.
And I think that's the other message Mueller is sending the next round of people who get closer and closer to Trump. Hey, you want to be the first one to raise your hand and say, I'll talk. You want to be the first one to the party to make the deal. It's going to work out way, way better for you.
Well, and we already have a few of those, right? There's that George Papadopoulos, cooperating. Yeah. And there's probably a few others.
So silly, Papadopoulos does. It's just so.
Well, it's
so
interesting.
So
he's really.
And
he's really like a minor character in
because
his role was very limited. But during that limited time, he was exposed to quite a lot. So.
And his claim to fame is he's the one that got hammered with the Australian, somebody from the Australian embassy, I believe, and let it slip.
Yeah.
And he was the one that got all of this, allegedly, if you believe the report out of the mostly the intelligence community. This all started with this low-level guy having too much to drink and spouting his mouth off to somebody that he had no idea had the ability to create this type of problem for him.
Yep, domino effect set into motion, chain of events that, you know, where we are today.
So this is why I'm not a criminal, because I have a huge mouth. And if I ever pulled off anything, I would just run around telling everybody, guess what I just did. And if you and I, like, committed a crime, You'd have to kill me because I would immediately tell nine people, guess what me and Brandon did? There'd be no way. And I think this whole thing just
So I probably would have like commit a crime with you to begin with. So that would,
if you were going to commit a crime, you want to pick a much better partner than me because I can't keep my mouth shut for anything. And if somebody offered me a deal to get out of trouble, 100% I'm rolling on everybody I know.
Well, that's what's so crazy about this. If you look at everything that was done and said in the course of the campaign, it's so shoddy. There's no attempt to, you know, be consistent, to conceal, to cover tracks. I mean, it seems like there was no direction. I mean, it was everybody operating at will. And it's like, how could they not think that this was going to come out?
It's like, we're going to get away with this by doing it so blatantly out in public.
Right.
To your point, there was never a concern that any of this might come back on us, or we may have to explain this, or this is, I just don't understand that. What gets me too, something we talked about last week, Trump has grown up in a courtroom. He's been involved in a lawsuit forever. If there's anybody that should know, hey guys, I've been around a lot of courtrooms and a lot of legal proceedings. This is how we want to cover this up a little bit if we're doing something to make sure that we can continually move forward.
But Craig, I think it goes back to ego and ambition. I mean, you're dealing with men, Trump, as well as those around him, who are just egomaniacs, and so they don't look at the situation logically. I mean, that's the reason that Trump wants to be able to meet with Mueller's team, because he thinks he can just talk around them and be able to, you know, do himself a favor, apparently.
Bob, just let me explain this to you, Bob. So you said something that just kind of stuck in my head that's interesting. So I'm gonna pose this question to you, trying to catch you off guard. You said these are men, which is accurate. Would a group of women politicians do this?
I don't think so.
I don't think they would,
and definitely not in the same way. And I mean, the motives and intent would be very different, because men and women are different biologically. And, you know, you see,
you're getting on shaky ground now, Brandon.
I'm just saying,
you say men and women are biologically different.
You see story after story of successful men, you know, a lot of ambition, big egos, getting into trouble. I mean, because again, it's impulsive and thinking in the moment. I think women are wired a little bit differently. You don't see that as often with them.
I agree.
There's an anomaly here and there, but for the most part, it's not as common.
And the hook to that is, you know, more women have run or running and are succeeding running than ever before.
Right.
You know, we certainly, when we get to Tuesday's elections, we can talk about, you know, the overperforming historic standards that women are experiencing right now. Maybe that's part of this.
Well, I think women tend to be more cautious, even in leadership positions and in those types of roles. Men tend to be more impulsive. I know that's generalizing, but I think that's true.
And I think women think things through.
Right.
And women think things through from a perspective. Oh, well, I'm me, therefore I can just get away with this. I think a woman would take a much more logical approach to saying, okay, if we chose to go this direction, here's how it could play out, and here's how I'm going to mitigate that. Where I think you're right, for like Trump, it's like, I've operated this way my whole life. I'll just bulldoze past anybody who gets
it's
in
the
my way.
It's the idea that he's been able to get away with it for so long, he just keeps moving the goalpost. But going back to your comment about women, I think a good example of that, I've worked with people in the party to recruit women for state legislative office as well as other offices. And it's interesting because, you know, we still struggle with an issue. There's always more men who want to run for office than women. Men tend to have a lot more ambition. So when I sat in these groups and talked to potential candidates, women.
Sorry, political ambition.
Political
men
ambition.
Have more political ambition.
And that's what I'm
women.
Talking about. Political ambition. Gotcha. Yep. We've sat around talking in these groups with like really successful women who have had great careers, who have been involved in civic and community organizations. And they're like, well, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I'm the best person for the job. I really need to think about this. Whereas if you talk to.
Because the most unqualified man in the room.
Right. You know, and
sign me.
He's like, I could do it. And I could time and time again. And in fact, you see, I've seen men who, you know, like, oh, I can do that. In fact, you know, I'm going to do that. And then, you know, a year later, run for this office. I mean, they're already thinking 10, you know, 20 years down the road because their ambitions are sky high. It's a very different mindset. And it can be frustrating at times if you, you know, because again, it's that idea of being thoughtful and really trying to look at the whole picture versus, you know, a guy who's just like, oh yeah, I can do that and I should. You know, I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread.
I've been married a long time. My wife is incredibly successful. There is no doubt that if you lined me and my wife up by any measure of intelligence, planning, organization, she runs circles around me. It's not even close. But there's that thing that you just talked about. If you asked, if you took both of us aside and said, which one of you would be present, could be president of the United States, my hand would go up and I'd give you 50 reasons why I'd be the most, and Jode would take a totally different tact to it. And I think that's just part, a lot of that is socialization. A lot of that is still kind of some traditional roles I think that women put themselves into. And
right.
it's just a long arc to break some of that thinking. But it's interesting that you're trying to talk to somebody about, you know, having a real shot at running for office, and that women still, they always look for the way to say no, while a man goes through very little self-analysis. I'm qualified for this, it's just, well, I'm a dude, of course I am. It's a dude world, and politics are all dudes.
It's a major difference is women want that additional self-validation.
Correct.
Because there is that caution, that restraint. Yeah. And with men, they don't need any validation from it. You know, it's all self-validation.
Isn't that the best part about being a man? You just self-validate on anything you want. You just move forward.
But see, when there's been potential candidates that are guys that I have consulted with, I've told them, I'm like, you know, talk to your wife, talk to your girlfriend, talk to a family member.
Why?
So that they have that, you know, reality to set in.
Yeah. Brandon, we just talked for 5 minutes. Can't you tell how awesome I am? Let's get this started.
Because I think it's critical to have somebody or multiple people to ground you. And so I think that's important. And I think, you know, the, you know, opposite takes place for a woman. They need to have people around them really say, no, you can do this and you should do this. And this is why. And you're the right person for the right time, the right moment. Yeah. You know, et cetera.
So part of why I was so excited to vote for Barack Obama was it felt like I was putting the period at the end of the civil rights movement. Wasn't around in the 60s when the marching and all of that and the ball started, but it felt like somehow for me getting able to vote for our first African-American president, in making that happen, I was participating in the one of the last, hopefully one of the last chapters in that movement within our country. Look what we did. This started with people who did all of the heavy lifting in the 60s. It's continued. Now I get to kind of add my name to that ledger by something that I did with voting for Barack Obama. It was very personal. It was something I felt like I absolutely had to do. It feels like with women and the vote that we saw Tuesday and certainly the drive into 2020, you're seeing some of this. Hey, I may have, I don't want to call it a mistake, but I couldn't vote for Hillary for any number of reasons. And those numbers are those reasons are completely legit. Not trying to invalidate anybody's decision. But women too, I think, women feel the need to correct mistakes. That's another core thing that men a lot of times, as we make mistakes, yeah. Oh, well, yeah. I'll just move on to
we
the
just
next
move
one.
On. We're
we
fine.
Just move on. There's the,
because we don't do a lot of self-reflection.
No. There's always another opportunity coming I'll just take advantage of.
That's right.
Women a lot of times, they feel the need to, wait a minute, I need to go back and make that right. And I think you started seeing some of that play out in Tuesday's election.
You did. And several big wins for women across the country. And I heard a statistic that the last time that we had this many women running for office was like 1992. And we've already surpassed that.
I thought this was like all-time high.
It is. What 1992 was like the peak,
okay,
and the,
I gotcha,
the, you know, for the last 50 years,
got
and
it.
So
now
we've surpassed
that.
That peak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think part of that is hey, I didn't like my last election. I may have sat out, or I may have third-partied it, or I may have just, you know, voted, you know, a Trump trier. Let me try this because we've never seen this before. Let's see what happens.
Let's not forget. I mean, this election was not. I mean, there was a large number of voters who, you know, they were not excited about their choice. There were a lot of Trump voters who weren't enthusiastic to vote for him, but, you know, they did not like Hillary Clinton. And so he was, you know, it was a reluctant vote. It was a vote taken very reluctantly. And so I think it's easy, you know, to forget that. If there were, he had a large number of votes that were just based on who his opponent was at the time. And I've said this time and time again, if you had had another Democrat, you know, generic Democrat, B or A
Joe
or
Biden
C
would
on the
be president right now if he had run.
Very different story. Yeah.
And I don't want to continue the psychoanalysis of women, because that's something probably neither one of us are qualified or feel comfortable doing. But I think we've all witnessed in work situations that there is something, I don't know what it is, that women sometimes have a problem supporting other women. That women have a weird sense. Men are overtly aggressive and competitive with each other when we sense that another man is a threat to me at work or politically or whatever. We just tend to be, our go-to move is to challenge you, be aggressive, you know, let's kind of openly fight this out.
Right, but men in the workplace also have a certain level of camaraderie too. You know, like
that's true.
Yeah, pat you on the back. Hey, you know,
I think men at work will let things go. We can fight it out, but when it's done, it's done.
No grudges.
Don't hold grudges as much. I think women, and I think this is some weird phenomenon that you saw with Clinton. Just they were looking for reasons and excuses not to do it, and I think that's something that maybe. I think what you're going to see in the midterms and into 2020, there's going to be much more of a galvanization of, okay, this time we're going to vote for women. We're going to support each other because we saw what happened the last time we didn't. We're going to correct that mistake.
Yeah, I think so. I would disagree on the premise. I don't think it was just because she was a woman. I think Hillary Clinton was a unique instance because she had years and years of public persona built up that, you know, was different than if it had been another woman contender or another from the House or the Senate or a governor, and very strong, very high negatives built up over, you know, 20-year period. So I think it puts her in a little bit different category, although you had some of that. You know, it's like in the workplace, I think women tend to be more competitive because they also feel, you know, that they're getting threatened on all sides. I mean, you know, they are trailblazers in many ways. And so they feel like they have to overcompensate because of, you know, the feeling that, you know, by men that they're inadequate, that, you're not really qualified for this role. And so they feel like they have to work harder and work smarter. And so because of that,
they get paid less along the way.
So they do
get punished for having children.
So in that instance, you know, other women, you know, they feel like they have to be, you know, more aggressive to compensate for that. And that includes towards, you know, other women.
And we, as Dems, what really was surprising, it is easy for me here to lob stuff at the Republican Party and Trump around. It's easy for me to lob something at the Republican Party around being sexist and misogynistic and war on women and all of those traditional stuff when Trump is your president. It's an easy target. But what really we didn't see coming in 2016 is the fact that we've never reconciled Bill Clinton's behavior.
Right.
And, you know, again, I thought how Trump did it was disgusting. It was one of the most uneasy kind of scenes I think I've ever witnessed in a presidential debate and just a campaign where he brought in
blatant political use. That's why, yeah.
But it also really struck a chord too. First, you were repulsed by it, and then you had to think through a little bit. Wow, there's a lot of behavior that if Bill Clinton would have done today, it would have been a completely different outcome. And you talk about somebody that's never acknowledged, who's never apologized, who has never made any attempt to go back and kind of square some of that up. Is Bill Clinton.
And I feel like the Democratic Party has this uneasy truce with Bill Clinton over what happened. They just, it's kind of like, we're not going to talk about it. We're just going to move on. And we really like him. And it's this back and forth. But the way his accusers were treated back in the 90s was appalling.
Compared to today's state. It was appalling back then. Not making an excuse for it, but especially in today's light. It's absolutely grotesque. Bill Clinton is like our VC angel investor as a Dem. Right. It's like, I run a business, Brandon, you got a bunch of money, and I know whenever I need it, I can just call you up and say, I need more to keep going because I'm out. Bill has been that whenever we need him, when we need him to support a candidate, when we need him to get out in front of something, when we need him to be the face of the party, we know we can trot him out, and he's played that role very well. That's one of the things we're missing right now. I mean, we can't bring out Bill because I think that that cycle ended in 2016, and Obama's too close to it.
Right.
And at the pace that Trump continues to attack Obama, eventually there's going to be this breaking of that norm where Obama would have to confront Trump on some of the stuff that he's doing, and we don't want to have to do that. And that leaves us faceless.
Right, because, I mean, the reason that Clinton was highly regarded because he had high popularity for so long.
Absolutely.
And he probably still does.
And
nobody
works it like Bill. Yeah. I mean, Bill is...
He's a likable guy. He's one of those that in poll after poll, people said they could have a beer with him.
He's aged a lot. He's only like 74, 75, but...
And, you know, he didn't seem to age like after his presidency.
Like all of a sudden, bang.
Yeah, it was just within like the last 5 years. It's really
aged. Bill was squeezed a lot out of his... out of his life. Yeah, Bill's led a pretty good existence.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is what one of the things that I liked about Tuesday as a Democrat was I think the Bernie Sanders era is officially over for us.
And I think that's really good for your party.
Thank God.
And probably really good for the country, because I think we've learned that mainstream establishment Democrats, that's where the pulse of the party is at based on the elections that happened, based on all of these primaries. And the fact is, I mean, that's really how you win around the country. And it's interesting because these are mainstream electable candidates, but they're also, it's a year of the woman, so there's women candidates, a lot of minority candidates. But it's all under this umbrella of mainstream Democrat values. It's not, the Bernie Sanders, Cortez segment of the party.
And I think there's no doubt Bernie Sanders got jobbed in 2016, without a doubt. What the Democrats did to him was not needed, not necessary, and should never have happened. If you, as a Democrat, and I'm talking to any Democrat that listens to the pod, if you use that for an excuse not to vote or to vote third party and threw your vote away against Donald Trump, I hope that's a lesson you've learned, and you come in 2020 a little bit more equipped to vote like an adult. Adults look at a situation, you pick the lesser of two evils sometimes and you go. And that's what we missed in 2016. And that's why we're here today.
I think this is somewhat of a uniquely American phenomenon. Americans get drawn in by, personality politics, this type of personality cult, mentality.
I agree.
I initially saw that with President Obama. I didn't think that was very healthy. And then you saw that magnified with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And, on both sides, you see this play out. And I don't think it's one side of the political spectrum or one party. But time and time again, we see this. You don't see that to a degree in other countries. I mean, it's more focused, broadly on the coalitions. But again, in other countries, you have multiple parties and you have coalitions.
Absolutely.
You can't focus on one personality.
Your election for prime minister is what, like 6 weeks?
Right.
It's not a 2-year process. It's an elected parliament that represents it. It's completely different.
And why should we have like a 2-year campaign? And again, it gets back
to why
we should rethink,
no,
some of these, long time practices, because I mean, are they really relevant in today's era?
You mentioned something a couple pods ago. You were like, well, it was easy for the founding fathers to say, the Supreme Court's a lifetime appointment because everybody dies at their 52. So no one would even consider appointing somebody that wasn't at least 40. If you get 10 decent years, you're good. Limiting the campaign cycle is another thing that there's no way they could have envisioned the media cycle, the process, the theater, the entertainment value that this would have and how this would become. And that definitely would fall into that democracy 2.0 bucket of let's take a different look at that.
Yeah, the media and exposure options back then, I mean, don't even hold a candle to what a modern day candidate
has to
go through.
The town yeller called your name for a couple of days and that was it. But I'm glad that the Bernie Sanders socialist approach for the Dems seems to have burned itself out. That was a natural reaction that was going to come to an end at some point. Let's move on to something that's a little bit more sellable
and
to broad scale America.
You know, that approach can work in some areas of the country, but it's not a mainstream approach that can work nationwide. And I think they've learned that after Tuesday.
In today's climate, being a middle-aged white guy who hosts a podcast that's listened by, I don't know, dozens of people probably, I still am hesitant to criticize Alexandria, say her middle name,
Ocasio-Cortez.
Although, even when she has earned that criticism roundly by her performance on the campaign trail, by her interviews, she did one with Cuomo
just recently,
which was
yeah.
absolutely ridiculous. In no way is that woman prepared to be the voice, the face of anything. And I'm saying I'm glad comes off wrong, but I'm glad that we can move on to other more serious things now.
I agree. I think that's therein lies the danger of jumping in on a narrative. Here's this narrative. You know, the party was excited because, you know, they have a win. They have somebody, you know, it's when you don't have a leader, you jump on it. But it was premature, as we learned, you know, sending her around the country to stump for candidates, most of whom did not win on Tuesday.
Not good. Yeah.
So it's like, let's back off of that. Let's, you know, focus more on long-term goal. Let's recruit good candidates that fit their districts around the country, which, you know, it seems to be working for you guys based on what happened Tuesday. And let's focus on that and not just, you know, anoint, you know, the first, you know, person who, you know, makes a splash.
And I think the trial balloon of socialism is done.
Yes.
You know, hey, we floated that up. It always has promise. We talked last week that there's a way you can package some of those concepts that can work into a mainstream platform, but you can't lead with that. And you can't lead with AOC being the person who brings that discussion into the Midwest, the Rust Belt, and onto the national.
I still argue overall this is a center-right country.
We are.
And so it's... I think your policies and your approach have to align with that. If you look at the Democrats that have been successful nationwide, you know, they have, you know, played to the center. They've run on proposals that are realistic and that are reform-minded, but they don't run to the end of the spectrum. They don't run on socialism and that we are going to have to do a full-scale, you know, overhaul of our entire system of government.
That's not where we're at.
Pass.
Let's talk about Tuesday a little bit, because some interesting things happened Tuesday. If you're a Democrat, you're feeling pretty good about it. I think if you're a Republican outside of Donald Trump, you see the writing on the wall. If you're a Trump Republican, you're trying to put the best spin on this as you can. Talking about what Trump's impact was on some of these elections. But the long and the short of it is the rural Republicans that voted for Trump in droves, their turnout was way down as their energy and excitement for Trump wanes. And something that we saw some research on this and then saw it play out on Tuesday, and this is what's most problematic for Republicans, the suburban white female college-educated Republican voter has completely disappeared under this administration. That's going to be tough.
It's non-existent. And Republicans can't win without suburban voters, and especially without suburban women. You know, that has been the crux of the presidential campaigns. If you look at we've only had one Republican in the last 18 years who has actually won the popular vote for president, and that was George W. Bush in 2004.
God, that just hurts when you say that, but it's true. But good night.
But yes, and he's the only one. But if you look at the 2004 presidential election, Bush won by winning in large numbers suburban women and suburban white women.
Yeah.
And that is the key to victory. Without that, you can't win the popular vote. And we're not in a presidential election right now, so we don't have to deal with the Electoral College. It is all about the popular vote when it comes to these congressional districts. And so I think Republicans have to see the writing on the wall. I mean, that they can't win. They have no Electoral College to come in and save the day.
No. I think too that there's always that old phrase, all politics is local. I don't think that's true this time around. I think right now all politics is national. And maybe this is how the media coverage and just the instant availability of everything has changed. But right now, the midterm elections, if you asked 1,000 Americans who their local congressman was, 20% could name them. My point is that right now, the R or the D in front of your name means more than it ever has before. And with Trump as the president of the United States, these elections are way more national referendums about parties than they are about individual local issues.
Absolutely. And I think that that's in part because of the president and his, you know, daily barrage.
And that's what's going to kill Republicans.
And that's going to be nonstop from here until Election Day. And there's going to be, you know, distraction after distraction and having to answer for whatever the president is saying today or tomorrow. And so you can't escape that. So it is nationalized. And you have the issue to contend with that you have Republicans that are playing defense. And then you had Devin Nunes, who was at a fundraiser got leaked, who basically said that they have to keep the majority in the House because they have to defend the president from impeachment.
So let me.
So that's going to go national, and Democrats are going to use that. And
so we don't get into a lot of back and forth Republican Democrat much because there's so much other stuff.
Yeah,
that
to talk about
that argument seems kind of trivial compared to everything else. But let me just ask, what's left of the Republican Party when Trump is gone? What core value still holds? It's not deficit. You've blown that out of the water. It's not. I understand the religious conservatives are hanging with you, but with
the
this
social
president,
issues,
you've sold your soul to have this one guy in there. It's not non-government intervention anymore, as now I guess everybody loves tariffs. It's It's not strong national defense. Because again, I mean, we just watched somebody under your banner stand up and basically make an ass of himself on the national stage multiple times.
And if that had been a Democrat, they would have been excoriated by my party. They would have been
what's crucified. Left? If I'm a Republican voter, give me some confidence of why this vote matters, or why should I vote Republican in this election?
There's tax cuts, and so I think you'll see the Republicans run heavily on the tax cuts that they put forth. Series.
Let me stop you right there. So, are you for President Trump, under executive order, cutting the capital gains tax by another $100 billion, and this one only goes to the wealthiest 1%?
I am not for that because I think that is not what executive orders are meant for, and I don't like him acting outside of the legislative branch
on
policy.
Would you vote for it if it went through the legislative branch?
I think that is reasonable policy depending on the extent. I think that marginally those can be cut and probably should.
Is that reasonable policy when we're $20 trillion in debt?
Well, there is that aspect of it. I mean, and the debt has grown substantially
under Trump,
and so you know, I think overall the tax reforms of past were good, but I do have issues with how large they were, with the fact that nothing was done to get the rein the deficit in. That's a big problem. Yeah. But like, if you look at like corporate taxes, I mean, we have, you know, been higher than much of the Western world, and so those were due to fall. I mean, we lose a lot of productivity that ends up going overseas because of our corporate tax rates. And there was argument for in other areas too to cut taxes, but again, it's about extent. And the fact of the matter is that we have reached a point where the party doesn't think deficits and debt matters anymore, apparently. I mean, it's ballooned.
And apparently that happened on November 4th of 2016, because for the 8 years Obama was president, it was a disaster every single day. We were destroying the lives of our grandchildren by this horrible man's fiscal policy. And with one vote, that thought got wiped out.
Exactly. I mean, politics at its best, right? I mean, we actually, the deficit was decreasing, and now it's risen again because of the policies of the current administration.
Absolutely. We're funding these tax. China is funding our tax breaks for us.
Well, and there's no defense of it. And then it's compounded when you have the president involved in disastrous trade policy and having to compensate by, you know, subsidies to farmers, you know, and the, you know, millions and millions of dollars. I mean, you can't justify that.
So do you think it feels like, I don't know if a wave is coming, but it feels like we'll take The Democrats will take the House by 5 to 10 seats.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to see a wipeout of 40, 50 seats like 2010 or 2012?
2010. And I think it would be hammered. Yeah, and it would be difficult because, again, with the the districts have been redrawn since 2010. And so, yeah. So many of these districts, there's very few swing districts left, and so many of them yeah. are so gerrymandered that, you can't have a wave, of
yeah.
the kind that we saw before.
I think we'll take a slim majority in the House. The Senate roughly stays about the same. There may be a plus one, plus two somewhere. But again, the only thing that matters in the Senate is getting 2/3 for an impeachment vote. And there's no way. So either side, we'll get to that.
No. And so we talked about this before. So I think the best you can hope for is basically logjam and to have, roadblocks yeah. set up. But you can have various committees, conducting investigations that are not happening now
yeah.
Of the president, of cabinet activities, that type of thing.
So as a Republican, what do you want to happen? Do you want to hold the House and the Senate, or do you want to have the House carved off to the Democrats?
I think
well, that's a tough question here, Brandon.
Yeah, you're really putting me on the spot.
You
yeah.
probably don't want to admit to.
So
you can say it. You can say it. Go ahead. I know you want to.
Honestly, I think it would be healthy for us to lose a House at this yeah. point. I think that we need accountability and we need checks and balances, and we're not going to have that if we hold the House, especially as the Mueller investigation heats up. And I think that we will have that. And considering the fact that Republicans will still hold the Senate
yes.
and you have more pragmatic members in the Senate, I think it'll be a good check and balance there. And so, I think that you have to have balance, and we're so out of balance now.
Well, and I think this exercise, too, has helped the American people see how absolutely useless the House of Representatives is.
Right.
The power in the legislative is completely consolidated into the Senate. The presidency has become a mini kingdom through executive order because the House simply refuses to get involved
passing
in
legislation.
Anything.
And ironically, they're giving more power to the executive branch and bolstering this idea of an imperial
willingly
presidency,
giving it up,
which was their same criticism of President Obama back.
Isn't
in
that shocking?
The last
for
8 years.
8 years, that was an attack on the Constitution and the fabric of America. But on the
and so different president, we're ready
Tuesday
to hand
November,
over power.
It just goes right to that's the way it should be.
So correct. So that is something I could not have ever imagined myself saying, 2 years ago, four,
as a,
eight,
yeah,
ten.
As a Republican.
But I think we've come to that place now where I feel like that almost has to happen. Like we have to be able to course yeah. correct, and that's the only way to do it.
So I think the Republicans have certainly gone through more change in the last 10 to 12 years than the Democrats have. And it feels like over the next 10 or 12, change is gonna happen much more for your team than mine. It feels like, again, the arc of history bends towards the Democratic Party. And I go back to, again, the classic definition of a conservative is to stand in the face of change and say no. It feels like for you guys, politically, that's going to get harder and harder and harder to do.
It is. And the party is flirting, experimenting with this notion of being inward-looking, nationalist, playing on xenophobic fears and anti-immigration fears, and being completely isolationist in many aspects. And so, long-term, I mean, that hasn't worked. I mean, you've seen political parties throughout our nation's history, take on that type of philosophy, but it's always temporary.
Together.
It never holds, it falls.
No.
So that's not a strategy long-term. So what happens to the party long-term? Where do we find ourselves? I would like to see us become more of a traditional right-of-center party like you would see in the UK with the Conservatives or the Liberals in Australia or the Conservatives up in Canada. If you look at those parties, they have had a much more successful track record back and forth because they have mainstreamed conservatism and it plays well. And they're all about, building empowerment societies, but it's including everybody. If you look at Canada specifically, the conservatives up there, and maybe it's because Canada is just so much more diverse, they've done a very good job of incorporating that level of diversity in their party structure and in like their the platform.
It's like the most conservative person in Kansas or in Canada is like your average liberal here. They're just so liberal to begin with.
I mean, it's not direct. I mean, you could say the same thing in the United Kingdom. I mean, the Conservative Party in the UK is more like a centrist Democrat in some ways.
6 weeks, but Canada, pot's legal everywhere.
I didn't know that was the timeline.
I think they said like September 15th or something.
Taking a trip there soon?
Oh, I got kids. So I keep track of, a 12-hour drive, you could be in Winnipeg.
Well, there's Colorado right here. I mean, that's like...
I know, but there's always something about doing something out of the country. You feel like you can't be caught.
Right.
In Colorado, if you put it in your car and drive around outside of Colorado, you're going to get busted.
That's true. Yeah, you got to be cautious. Kansas is going to get you
if you bring it there. In Canada, you've got a whole big country you could just roam around.
Yeah,
so.
You can have some fun for a while. Yeah.
So let's talk about, you made a great point as we were starting out that in case anybody's forgotten, we still have about, 500 or 600 kids that the government forced separated at the border that we have not found a way to get back to their parents yet.
Yeah, and I've seen conflicting reports on this. I've seen some reports that indicate that some of these parents they can't find at all, so they don't know what to do with these children. They literally have lost records of the parents and their names and that type of pertinent information, which really is startling. And so what do they do? I mean, do they place them in some type of,
foster care facility? Out, I would think.
And it's unbelievably, again, it points to incompetence. I mean, just complete ineptitude and incompetence on the administration, not having a plan, because again, this was a political move and they didn't really care about the consequences, the aftershock.
This sounds like Stephen Miller written all over it, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. I mean, he was directly advising on this. But the bigger picture is you have a court case that's making its way through federal court, and you had the administration argue that the ACLU should be tasked with reuniting the children with their parents.
Can you explain that at all to me? Because last time I checked, the ACLU is not a government entity.
They are not. No, they're a nonprofit. And apparently this seems to be a case of, because the ACLU has been a critic of the administration on this point, they've just thrown it back at them and say, oh, well, you should do it then.
Well, if you like it so much, why don't you do it?
Right. I mean, it makes no sense logically. I'm surprised that they get more play. It's ridiculous, but it's also symptomatic of how this administration thinks.
So how do you place this in historical context? My side saw this and there was legitimate outrage. Your side had legitimate outrage.
Right.
It is totally acceptable for any American citizen to say that is 100% wrong. Then we have to go to the people that compared this to worst thing in history since Pearl Harbor. Then we had to go to the people who started throwing around Nazi references and things like that. And it quickly escalated, and more on my side, to where we're completely historically inaccurate about what this is. And we've gotten to this point now where we're not... Our rhetoric is, I get it, use this as a political chip. You should be outraged by the behavior, but you're overreaching in it. But this is about separating kids. How should we think about this in the historical context as Americans? I think it's still something where we're struggling with.
It is, because we don't really have any direct historical comparison for that.
This isn't putting Japanese people in internment camps.
It's not. It's not on that level. And so you kind of lose the argument if you try to make those comparisons.
Correct. It's not Nazis.
Right.
We have a strict policy on the pod. I don't think I've ever told you, Brandon, we do not make Nazi references here.
Hey, I'm all in favor.
Anybody makes Nazi reference, the response is read a book, because you don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Well, and so I think you have to look at it as it does represent who we are as a country. And I think that's why most Americans are – grappling with and struggling with the right reaction, because we know innately that it's wrong and it doesn't feel right, and it's not who we are, and that we don't do this. I mean, we're the land of opportunity and we're the land of freedom, and we were forged by families coming here in many circumstances for a better life. And so there obviously is, you know, so many better ways to handle this. And so the fact that this was, you know, the action that was taken, I think people are uneasy with it, but it's about trying to find the right reaction. But I think you focus on the fact that, you know, this is what happens when you play politics with an issue that impacts so many people. And then you have incompetent officials serving in your administration who can't fix the situation.
Yeah. And there was, I read an article, and I'm going to get this wrong, but there was a program that the Trump administration shut down prior to all this happening, where individual families served as foster parents for kids, migrant kids separated from their parents. And they're like, that was a great program. Yeah. It was a cheap program. It made sense on every level. You cannot tell me, as Americans in the Southwest, you couldn't have gotten thousands of families to volunteer to say, we are sympathetic to this plight. We understand the issue. We will house these kids for as long as it takes as a foster kid. And the fact that we went for maximum punishment, it seems like. We took away programs that would work to maximize the shock value of what we were doing. Right. That just, as an American, that just makes me sad. It's like, that's what really gets to...
Well, that's what's sad, is that this was being used as a deterrent, really, and it's not, and it has not been a deterrent. And in the meantime, you have people that have been caught in the crosshairs and can't be reunited with their children.
Using people's kids in any way is just... I think that's another thing, getting back to women, that's not going to set well with women. It doesn't matter your ethnicity, your college education level, separating a child from their mother, that's not going to work. And I think that policy you're going to see that boomerang in the midterms.
Yeah, I think this will be a defining issue. I also think, you know, obviously there were some children who were being brought over by traffickers and the like, but the problem is, because apparently good records were not kept, we have no way of knowing, you know, the parents that should be reunited with these children, you know, who, you know, is where. And I mean, it seems to be kind of all over the place. And that's...
How do you take a scared immigrant who, yes, they did something illegal. They are crossing our border illegal. Nobody's making the argument that that's not illegal.
Right.
How do you separate them from their child and then, by some accounts, try to force them to sign something that they're giving up their reunification rights with their children to be deported and not charged with a crime, which is a common story. Who does that? Oh, who thinks to do that?
It's wrong. But now you have these children that are having to testify on their own without the assistance of court-appointed advocates.
6-year-old into,
you know,
court.
In front of a judge, in front of an immigration judge.
It's ridiculous.
No. You know, the other thing that the administration could have done is fund more immigration judges to be able to try these hearings to speed up the process, because there's a shortage of these immigration judges. And so the hearing process is extended because of this. And
change the process.
Yeah.
This is another 2.0 democracy discussion. Why are we housing somebody in jail for 6 weeks to go in front of a judge and say guilty when they parade you in with 75 other people to illegally crossing the border? Can't we take Brandon, make you take a course and pass a test on judicial immigration policy, and you are not the judge. You are the, help me out with what word I'm looking for. You're the adjudicator. And we have thousands of you, and you look at a check criteria. They are bumped up to a judge. Why can't we just use our head to come up
with
some common sense relief for this problem?
I was pre-law in college, by the way. So
you're in. You're the first one. It's not that hard.
No, and I think you can train so many people to be able to do this. And again, change the process, change the increase the number of adjudicators you have. You know that there's a problem. You know that, you know, you have this this backlog. Do something about it.
Retired military folks, retired police officers, people that have been around the legal system. Wouldn't it be and they'd love to do it.
But Craig, it's not a priority. It's clearly not a priority of the administration. So they haven't invested any resources at all.
It's a black eye that they just want to sweep under the rug.
They'd rather forget about it.
Talking about low unemployment numbers and how the economy's booming and it's the greatest American boom time.
If it was a priority, you would have a plan. It's clearly not when you tell a judge that ACLU should be doing this. I mean,
that's a joke. So speaking of jokes, I haven't gone on a good Fox News rant in a long time.
Here we go.
Did you hear what Laura Ingraham said the other, I think it was last night in her opening monologue or one of her segments?
I did.
Immigration is causing us to lose ourselves as Americans.
I read an article. I think S.E. Cupp had posted it. She's a conservative commentator on CNN.
I'm kind of getting an old man crush on S.E. Cupp. I'm liking her more and more.
So if you want to follow somebody who's right of center, conservative, but pragmatic and smart, follow her on Twitter.
Yeah, she's a good Twitter follower.
She's great. She's and actually, we've talked on Twitter before, but she knows her stuff and she's reasonable. And she had a good, I mean, she really criticized Laura Ingraham over this. But I mean, the fact that Laura Ingraham isn't even trying to hide it.
No.
I mean, it's basically, she said demographics are changing. It's a threat to us. And oh yeah, by the way, we need to look at legal immigration, not just illegal.
Legal immigration is causing us to lose parts of America that we love. That I think that's verbatim what she said.
Right.
How can you take that any other way of playing on white people's fears that the country is becoming more brown?
Well, I mean, that's what it is. It's playing on the, you know, audience that's, you know, 60 to 65 plus,
which
her audience.
Which loves Fox News.
I think what's shocking about it is she's not trying to hide it. She was very direct.
Wow. Well, when's the last time you consumed 7 to 10 o'clock, the three opinion shows on Fox? Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, and the king of all bad shit, Sean Hannity.
I think like a couple weeks ago, but I consume them. I only like 5 to 10 minutes a time. I can't watch like an entire show.
You can't choke down 90 minutes back to back.
It's been a long time. They all sound the same too. I mean, they're all parroting
talking each
points.
Other stuff.
Yeah.
God, Giuliani got on there again and just, that guy's insane.
I think he mentally has lost his marbles. I mean, even if you just hear how he talks now, like he doesn't seem like he's all there at all. He doesn't seem like the same, you know, Giuliani we knew back in 2001, 2002.
Brandon, I can tell you, as I'm staring 50 in the face, every day it goes away. If you're 60, I mean, Julian is almost 70 some odd years older. He's over 70. The pace he's on, there's no way. And physically, he's in horrible shape. I can definitely tell you, you're not all there, not as much as there as you were at 40 than you are at 70. There's just no way.
And that's why every time you see him, you know, trotted out, it's cringeworthy, you know, news. It's like, I can't believe I'm watching this.
Are you interested in the Omarosa tapes?
I just heard about that, actually. not surprised.
Here's what's so funny. Trump is, of everybody that could have taped him, it wasn't Obama, who he claimed, and wasn't the DOJ. It was Omarosa and Michael Cohen.
Yep.
The two sleaziest people he surrounded himself with. Guess what? They're the ones.
Well, guess what? Omarosa, I mean, she had a job where she didn't do anything anyway. She was getting paid like $150,000 a year, had no responsibilities. So she just walked around and recorded him, basically.
Omarosa had no business being anywhere near the White House.
Right.
And it was a total joke when he hired her. And I hope it comes back and bites him right in his ass.
Well, and she's writing apparently a tell-all book, too, about her experience in the White House. So that should be
fun. She claims he's mentally lost his faculties.
Yeah.
Isn't this just it's a great lesson for the next generation. When you surround yourself with slimy people, they do slimy things.
Hey, yeah, don't be surprised.
The content of your character is judged by the company you keep. And that, there it is.
That just says it all with this administration. Yeah.
So I'm glad we're back to depressing news. Children missing, Omarosa, America, all of that. We're about at the end of our hour here. What else can we throw in? I thought we did good with recommending some books one time. That was good.
Yeah, we did. I did want to recommend magazines, periodicals, people wanted to follow. So there's two that I really enjoy reading that I think are reasonable, thoughtful analysis, and dive deeper into issues than much of our media do. So the first one is The Economist, which is considered right of center, but barely right of center. And the good thing is you get commentary about what's happening in other parts of the world. It's very much more of a global perspective than you would get elsewhere. And then the other one is The Atlantic, which is technically left of center. Again, great analysis, though, great pieces, a lot of good writers. Both of those I read on a regular basis. So if you want good, thoughtful analysis that's not, you know, knee-jerk sound bites and rhetoric and talking points, read those too.
Maybe next week we need to catch up with the media and kind of where the media is right now.
The landscape, media landscape.
Jim Acosta, do you follow him at all, or have you... With the CNN guy, that's the main...
I do, but he gets on my nerves. I feel like he's
such a smug, arrogant...
And he's very overdramatic.
I get it. When he's going at Sarah Huckabee Sanders, nobody has sympathy for Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But there's just the dripping of just, oh my, you've got to be kidding me.
His message gets lost due to those antics. I think it's harder to, even though I think the message is good, it doesn't resonate because you're focused on, you know, his...
And how much of that's going to impact midterms and politics and culture in as we move forward?
Oh, the media?
It feels like it's going to do a lot more than we think.
That it has in the past, yeah. And I think as we get closer to the midterms, it'll be really interesting, again, network by network, medium by medium, to watch how all of this is covered.
And as a Republican, you've always hated the media, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I think there's been truth, too. Overall, you know, the media, there's been bias there, implicit bias.
Hated the media. It felt the media doesn't cover you as fairly as they should.
Agreed, and I think that's always been a problem. But I think there's a difference. We've reached a turning point now where you basically have a president who... demonizes the media on a weekly basis and says they're the biggest threat, enemy of the people. That is out of bounds. There's a poll out of the New York Post, I think I mentioned this to you offline, where they polled Republicans on the media. I think it was 34% of Republicans said that Trump should be able to shut down the media.
He should be able to shut... One third of your party thinks the president should shut down the media.
That's scary. That's frightening.
Hell, completely out of everybody.
And so I don't know how we've gone from media bias to that, because that is a bridge too far, way too far.
That is. All right, I think we're done for the week, man.
Okay,
take it easy.
You too.